stop your offenses. So we should understand this, that we have to voluntarily give up our tendency to commit offenses. It means we have to watch ourselves. And when we see we're getting a little offensive, then we have to say no. We have to stop ourselves like that. So then, going down to the bottom of the page, second to last paragraph, he explains what is the effect of this anatta. If you do this, if you commit offenses, what happens to you? So he says that the case of the offender losing the mercy of the name is similar to a subordinate, like a worker or a servant, who's offensive to his vastly wealthy and capable master. He is denied proper care and is treated indifferently by the master. As a result, that person comes to suffer poverty and distresses of all sorts. In other words, you will end up suffering terribly if you commit offenses. You'll end up bewildered, distressed, in anxiety, as they say in the devotee vernacular, fried. You'll be fried to the max. And it'll be too much. And you'll be trying to do something, but it will be so hard. So, this is the result of offending. But if the offending servant again puts himself at the beck and call of his master, the master gradually shows mercy. So if you just stick at it, of course you should apologize to the devotees for your offenses to them or whatever. Try and make up that, I'm sure you're hearing about them. But otherwise, you should just stick at your chanting, stick at your devotional service, and gradually the Lord will give mercy again, and you'll be able to get into it again. So he says, thus one cannot argue against the gradual elimination of anathas. If you're sincere, even if you make mistakes, even if you commit some offenses, but if you're sincere, then you'll be able to pull through eventually. Anyway, I think we'll call that a day. There is more, but you know, time isn't really there, and it's rather detailed. So, any questions? Comments? Words of wisdom? Do you have to know where you are? The question is, do you have to know where you are? Well, I know you, of course we're in Phoenix. But as far as where you are in devotional service, which I think is what your question relates to, well, it's an extremely good idea. Because at least you know what is forward and what is backward. If you don't know where you are, you may think that something that is way forward is your next step. And you may think that something which is an immediate problem you have is a problem you don't have. So we said at the very beginning, perhaps you weren't here, that it's actually very important to at least have a reasonable idea where you are. Because then you'll know what to do and what not to do in order to systematically advance in a practical way. So yes. The answer is yes. You need to know where you are. Any other questions or comments? So I know you won't have time to read anything. But if you want to, you can. As far as I'm concerned. And it'll probably be worthwhile. So you could be ready for the discussion tomorrow. But in the meantime, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you. So today we're going on with our discussion of Madhurika Dhamini. We're going on to chapter 4, page 18. The fourth shower of nectar. More and more nectar is showering on us. Very nice. So anyway, yesterday we discussed about Bhajana Kriya, when a person actually begins engaging in devotional service. They actually take up devotional service. This is what Bhajana Kriya means. Now, do I have to write all the nine stages on the board? Are you all sort of tuned in enough? Okay. So, Bhajana Kriya. On the level of Bhajana Kriya, which means that the person is basically beginning their devotional activities. They're not experienced at all, but at least they have begun and they're seriously engaging in devotional service. So there are six types of problems, you could say, or six types of obstacles. I won't write them all, but Utsahamai was one, then Ganatarana, Yudhavikalpa, Vishaya Sangara, then Niyama Akshara, and Taranga Rangani. Yeah. So these are obstacles. But we say they're kind of like childish obstacles. They're really more related, at least, to the earlier stages of devotional service. Although, having said that, that does not mean that they are completely restricted to just the beginning levels. Even a person who is somewhat more advanced may also get into Yudhavikalpa, unable to decide what to do, what not to do in a particular situation. And devotees may also accept different vows that they shouldn't really do, feeling that this may help in their devotional service, even when they're more advanced than just that beginning stage. So, it's like that. So that's Bhajana Kriya. One is trying to get established in devotional service, get a firm footing, and not get swept away by any of these things. Then, when one is seriously engaged in devotional service and has a little footing, and is actually making a little progress, then one is confronted by, on the next level, Anatta Nivritti. With, like, deeper problems, you could say. I mean, not that it gets worse. It might sound like we're saying it gets worse. Actually, it's getting better all the time. But it just becomes these things become more apparent that they exist. So there are four types of anathas, as we discussed yesterday. Coming from our previous sin, our previous piety. From offenses. And you could say our mistakes. So from our mistakes, as we're trying to develop, practice devotional service, but we don't always know what to do in some situation. So we may make a wrong decision, but it's not really an offense, but it is something which isn't really the right thing. And it may have certain consequences. So then we also discussed how these are nullified. Particularly, we noticed that the anathas arising from offenses. Now, of course, offenses are anathas, that's one thing. But they have certain effects which are anathas, which are unwanted things. And we read a little bit yesterday how someone who commits offenses, the example was given of a servant of a wealthy master who somehow or other gets on the wrong side of the master and then is neglected by the master. But then, as long as the servant carries on very faithfully, eventually the master may accept him again. So, like that, if one commits offenses, then one's position in devotional service and one's taste for devotional activities reduces. so that one may chant and chant and chant even. But one is finding it a big struggle, like this. So the effects of these anathas, they can linger on for a long time. On the level of nishtra, of course, there's a fairly significant eradication of anathas due to offences. Fairly significant. Although it only really becomes more complete on the level of prema and absolute when you directly enter into your eternal relationship with the Lord. Then, sin and piety, they are overcome quite quickly. By the time you get to nishta, more or less they're overcome, and they're absolutely overcome on the level of ruchi. And your mistakes, a similar type of situation, on the level of nishta, they're more or less completely removed, and then apparently on the level of asakti, they're absolutely removed. But at least in the cases of these three, 1, 2, and 4, by the time you get to the level of nishta, nishta means steadiness, being fixed in devotional service. By the time you get to that stage, the effects of all these things, your tendencies towards, or the effects of these things, is to a very large extent gone. And even the effects, when you get to the level of nishta, being fixed, this would indicate that you are not committing any more offences at least. Otherwise, if you're committing offences, that means you're not fixed, because offences are not part of being fixed, they're the opposite. So, on the level of anatha nivritti, you may still be committing offences, but of course it'll be lessening, because on the level of anatha nivritti, you're trying to nullify the unwanted things. So even offences, even though the effects do go on after nishta, but still on the level of nishta, the effects of your offences generally will not be so significant. So we're coming to the level of nishta right now, at least in our discussion, and hopefully otherwise. But anyway, at least in terms of our discussion. So nishta, in other words, is a very good stage. It's a very good stage. It's actually quite an advanced stage. Your mistakes in bhakti are finished. No more mistakes. Because if you make a mistake, that means you're not fixed. Your offences are finished, and basically any attachments to sin, piety, and the effects of your mistakes are essentially finished. So it's pretty advanced, a good stage to be on. Anyway, so that's a little summary of what we discussed yesterday and leading us into what we're going to discuss today. So let's have a look now on page 18, chapter 4. Now there's a reference at the beginning, unfortunately because of computer problems that didn't print out so clearly, but you'll see a couple of verses there. Srinvatam Swakata Krishna Punyashavam Kirita Narija Taksto Yubajani Vidunati Savitsatam. How many of you have heard of this verse, or a little familiar with this verse? One. Okay. So, we won't go into this verse too much, or the next verse. If you were familiar with these verses, then we could go into them, because they're very important verses, actually. So I won't even go so much into what is being discussed about them. But the basic point is that when a devotee comes to the level of nishta, steadiness, or rather as the devotee is approaching the level of nishta, meaning they're not on the level of nishta yet, but they are actually in like the higher levels of anatha nivritti. Then, if you look in the last paragraph, Well, let's look in the second to last paragraph to start off with. He's saying that, referring to these two verses which unfortunately we're not so familiar with, but he's saying that on the level of Nishta, only a small portion of anathas remain. Now, it is a fact that even though we've got this level called anatha nivritti, which implies we're nullifying all our anathas, and then you come to Nishta where you're fixed. So the implication is no more anathas. But actually on the level of Nishta there are still some anathas. That's a fact. That's a fact. Particularly, more than anything in terms of the results of your offences. Then, let us just, in order to tie this in, turn over to page 19. And we got that verse there towards the top of the page in the translation. Then the paragraph underneath the translation of the verse, you see that? Here the word cha is used. Here the word cha is used again. Remember Shiva Sya cha? So here is Kama Loba Loba Daya cha. Lust, greed, and what? It doesn't say. But it's understood that there's an and certain things. Anyway, that's a little Sanskrit grammar for us. Sanskrit is a very brief language. So it's not saying and what, but we understand that means and other problems. Lust, anger, greed, and many other things. Anyway, here we say, here the word cha is used in its collective sense, and so on. Thus, on the stage of Nishta, the modes of ignorance and passion are no longer present. However, these certain words, atire, anavi, dham, indicate that some impurities are still present to some slight degree at the stage of Nishta, but they're not really obstacles. Therefore, Nishta means Nishta. That the devotee is steady, even though some anathas are still there. You get the sense? That not that the anathas are gone, therefore steadiness is there. But that steadiness is there, even though some anathas are still present, but they're not present enough to make a big difference. So therefore, generally, a devotee on the level of Nishta will not fall down, will never fall down. The devotee on the level of Nishta generally will never fall down. Now, of course, there are exceptions. Because, as we know, the effects of your offences may last on to bhava, prema like that even. Can any of you think of an example of one devotee, this is of you have read Shantaram, please, one devotee who was well beyond Nishta, but he fell down. Maharaj Bharat, in the fifth canto. He was on the level of bhava, or at least the beginning stages of bhava. But he fell down, became attached to a deer. I'm sure you've all at least heard of the story. Became attached to a deer, and then he became a deer in his next life. So he really fell down. And actually he was well beyond Nishta, on the level of bhava, which is very advanced. So, why? Actually, the Bhagavatam doesn't really offer an explanation of exactly how it happened. Obviously, something arose from his heart and he got overpowered by it. But exactly how it happened isn't explained in the Bhagavatam. But from this explanation here, we can understand that it must have been the results of some previous offences. Because all the effects of his previous sin, piety, and minor mistakes in devotional service were already absolutely removed, totally non-existent within his heart. Anyway, his example is there, that's a fact. But still, we should know that essentially anyone who's on the level of Nishta, what to speak of bhava, it's extremely unlikely they're going to fall down. Actually, the great majority of their impurities and weaknesses, deficiencies, lackings, any things which might cause them to fall down, the great majority of those things are gone. almost completely, but not quite completely. So that means that when a person comes to the level of nishta, advancement is very fast. Up to the level of nishta, when you're going through your utsaha mai, your ganatarala, your vyuda vikalpas, and having struggled through them, coming face to face with the anathas arising from your previous sins and all the rest of those, actually, you may stay there on those levels for many lifetimes. If you're not serious. If you're serious, then you can also go through quickly. But if you're not so serious, if you're not really serious, I mean, you have to be really serious, actually. It's a fact. If you're not really serious, then it's not like there's going to be some automatic process that you're just going to find yourself going higher and higher. There's one verse spoken by, I don't know if it's Lord Chaitanya himself, but it's in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Bahu janma kare yadi shravana kirtana. Something, how does it go? Something or other. Tabe Krishna premadana or something. That Bahu janma. For many lifetimes, kare yadi, shravana kirtana. You may go on hearing and chanting for many lifetimes. But the idea is that if you do your hearing and chanting offensively, you may not achieve Krishna Prema Dana, the goal of Krishna Prema. Now, the person who has come to the level of Nishta has gone beyond those things, basically. So from that point, obstacles, there are no really substantial obstacles, at least. So from the point of nishta, advancement can be very, very fast. So we should all come to the level of nishta. Okay? Right. So let's do it. Let's do it. Let's do it today. Let's do it now. Let's not put it off till after lunch. Anyway, so here we are. According to our estimation, if you would like a wild guess, we are all somewhere around Bhajana Kriya and Anatha Nivritti. We are all somewhere around there. That is an approximation. Some of you may be much more advanced. We could expect that would probably be the case. Because I know you're all committed devotees, you all are. You're all committed to Krishna consciousness. But I feel that this is probably likely, that we're all like working through our conditioning, trying to sort it out and get past it. So now here, if you look, now going back to page 18, right at the bottom, the last paragraph, let's see. Oops. So he talks about, you could say they're like five final obstacles. Five final manifestations of anatha that the devotee will be confronted with before actually finally getting to nishta. So they're like the last sort of hang-ups before getting to nishta. And they're listed out there. You can number them 1 to 5. Laya. You see that there? Laya. Vikshetha. And a putty putty. So mark these 1 to 5 and learn them, or at least make a note of where they are, so when you head out, yes, you can get the answer right. Kashaya. And what is it? Rasasvara. So these are like, you could say, refined anathas. We're getting more refined here. These are anathas also, these six under Bhajana Kriya. They're definitely anathas. The ones under Anatha Nivritti, those four, they're more substantial and deeper. And these five here, these are like the last traces of anatha that a person will experience as the person is just sort of about to come to the level of Nishta. So now if we turn the page again, back to page 19. In the first paragraph, he gives a little more extensive explanation of what each one is than what you got in the last paragraph of the previous page. So laya, what is laya? Sleep, and not just sleep. I mean, you have to sleep. But laya refers to the tendency to sleep during, first of all, chanting, then hearing, then remembering, and so to speak, in order of increasing tendency. In other words, you're least likely to fall asleep in the middle of a kirtan. I would hope you would. It would appear that's what some people do. But now, when it comes to hearing, like you're all hearing now, if I was just sitting down here and sort of mumbling away to myself, we might all fall asleep. Including me. And then what to speak of when you're just remembering Krishna, just like a meditation, thinking of some pastime or some philosophy or something like that. So he's saying that there's an increasing tendency, less with kirtan, more with hearing, and more when it's just mental, just remembering. So laya refers to that tendency. That tendency. There was one devotee. Anyway, there's so many stories about devotees falling asleep. I don't know if we should get into it. There was one devotee who was fanning one of our spiritual masters once. And I don't know exactly how it was working, but he was sort of up on a raised level next to him. And he was fanning. And he fell asleep. And he fell right on the back. And went rolling down. Up on the ground. So devotees fall asleep. They're trying to reduce their sleep. Karmis, they sleep for hours and hours. And if they need to, they take a pill to keep them awake if they have to. But devotees don't do things like that. So, yeah. So nishta means that this isn't happiness. Anyway, so let's just go through these five. So that was laya. Tendency to fall asleep. So when you're on the level of nishta, seeing this is a last trace of anatta before you get to nishta, the idea is that when you're on the level of nishta, you don't fall asleep. When you're not meant to. You don't. That when there's hearing and chanting about Krishna, then you're naturally attracted because you're fixed and you become absorbed. And even if you are tired, even if you haven't had much sleep the night before or something like that, but you won't fall asleep because that transcendental sound is actually touching the heart and you're on that level, the level of the heart. So your consciousness is really becoming absorbed in that transcendental sound. So that means that if you have a tendency to fall asleep in Srimad Bhagavatam class or when you're reading, one devotee told me that my reading is a series of experiences of waking up. He doesn't even know that he's falling asleep. But when he wakes up, he realizes, oh, I fell asleep. So all these things happen with devotees. But in a sense, it's a sign of advancement. At least they're trying to read. So then vikshepa means that you're engaged in your service. He gives the example that you're chanting japa. But then someone comes along and you get distracted. Someone comes walking in with the latest magazine of a certain type that you have had some interest in, Time magazine or some movie magazine or whatever, something. And you're sitting there chanting, but then you see, oh, there goes the magazine. that these types of things, which you may normally have been attracted to, but now you're not, because you're actually, your consciousness becomes more absorbed in your spiritual activity. Then a pratipati, this is interesting, refers to an inability to become absorbed in spiritual activity, even when there isn't anything to distract you. It means just a lack of interest. There's no specific sort of competition that your mind may get attracted to. There's no other thing, but that you just can't get into it like that. So a type of indifference, apathy, which stops you from becoming absorbed. Then kashaya means, well, bad habits. Sometimes you may get a little irritated with people when there's no real need, or a little proud like this. Traces of these bad psychological habits. Then rasasvada. This refers actually to the tendency to become sensual, that you may remember some previous experience, something like that, of sense gratification. And so your mind then starts drifting into that rather than being absorbed in the Krishna conscious activity. But we're talking here more like traces of these things. So, nishtita bhakti, or the level of nishta. Nishta means the absence of these things. The absence of these last weaknesses. So one is coming to the level of goodness. Then he goes on to say, you go down, just the paragraph after the one which is talking about how these things aren't an obstacle, starts nishta. See that there, nishta, steadiness, is of two types. So this is an interesting point. Two types of steadiness. One is steadiness in bhakti, and the other is steadiness in things which are related to bhakti, but not actually bhakti. So, In the same paragraph, he talks about bhakti directly. Sakshat bhakti. Sakshat means directly. So there are three main divisions: bodily, vocal, and mental. Then he goes into a little discussion about different opinions on which is most important, which we won't really go into. But the basic idea is that steadiness in bhakti means being fixed in bodily service, active service, being fixed in speaking or chanting about Krishna, and being fixed in thinking of Krishna or devotional service like this. Then the next paragraph, things related or things favorable, secondary things. They're not directly part of bhakti, but they're related. Like humility, that's obviously related to bhakti, but it's not directly part of it. Being respectful, being friendly, being merciful, not being proud, not getting angry with people, being peaceful, tolerant. So these are all secondary types of qualities. So he goes on, actually in the same paragraph, to say that you may find a devotee who is very fixed in these secondary qualities, very humble, very peaceful, doesn't get agitated when something goes wrong. But as far as his bodily engagement or his vocal engagement or thinking of Krishna, his actual engagement in devotional activities, he's not always engaged. Sometimes he may talk some nonsense. Sometimes he may not engage in devotional service. He may just, as they say, space out and just sort of, you know, you can't find him when he should be doing his service, like this. So now, you may think, because he has so many nice personal qualities, you may think this person is actually on the level of nishta, fixed, because he's undisturbed and, you know, like that. But actually he's not really nishta. But then on the other hand, he goes on to explain that you may find, he says, an arrogant devotee. A devotee who's proud and prone to get uptight sometimes and be a little unpleasant. But then you see that this devotee is always engaged in devotional service, always. Always actively engaged, always chanting, like this. So that even though there's a lacking in the secondary qualities, still we will accept that that devotee is on the level of nishtha. Even though there's a lackings in these other secondary qualities, which according to the people in material life, they would think would be more important. So Prabhupada even, would get extremely angry. And people would say, oh, Swami isn't meant to get angry. And they would think this is a defect, but it's certainly not a defect at all. So, like this, of course Prabhupada is beyond nishtha, but at the very least on the level of nishtha through being so completely engaged in devotional service. So, as a little summary then, so a summary, last paragraph, sums it up very nicely. What has been shown is that laxity or intensity of effort and difficulty or ease in being absorbed in devotional service, such as hearing and chanting, is the criteria for discriminating whether the devotee is nishtha or not nishtha. This is the basic point here. Whether they're really fixed in devotional service or not. So nishtha means pure devotional service. Nishtha means pure devotional service. There's nothing else. Simply devotional service. Simply fixed always in devotional service. So nishtha is a very advanced level, actually. So now, let's go on to ruchi. We're now going into some pretty high levels of devotional service. Ruchi means taste. The idea is that the devotee is now fixed in devotional service. So when you're fixed in devotional service, naturally taste will be there. Naturally. Because devotional service means that one is absorbed on the spiritual platform. And spirit means blissful, Satchitananda. So naturally a taste will be there. There's a nice, the bottom of page 19, there's a nice description, very nice description, of some of the basic symptoms or characteristics. When the devotee takes in his heart the golden medallion of bhakti, shining effulgently by the fire of steady practice, nishtha, and propelled by its own energy, ruchi appears in the heart. A taste appears in the heart. When a person develops a taste for the activities of bhakti, such as hearing and chanting, vastly greater than attraction for anything else, that is called ruchi. So now this is very advanced level, isn't it? Vastly greater than the attraction for anything else. So, that means that if, going back to Laya, falling asleep, when there's actually one story, you may have heard this Puranic story, that at the beginning of creation, Nidra Devi, have you heard of Nidra Devi? We all know her very well. She's the deity of sleep. She was concerned, she was expressing to Lord Vishnu, beginning of creation, that I'm able to carry out my service to you, meaning put people to sleep, very nicely. But I have one problem, that is with your devotees. Your devotees are always hearing and chanting about you. So I'm not able to do my service on them. Meaning I'm not able to get your devotees to fall asleep. So I feel that's bad. I want to be able to carry out my service completely. So you have to give me some opportunity so I can do my service with your devotees, or put your devotees to sleep. So Lord Vishnu thought for a minute and he said, all right, if my devotees are inattentive during Srimad Bhagavatam class, then you can do your service on them. Yes, during hearing Srimad Bhagavatam class. So Nidra Devi was quite happy with that, and it appears she does quite a good job. Or alternatively, we are not being attentive enough. I think that's more like it. So the idea is that when a person is, say, on the level of Bhajana Kriya, they're just beginning, and they don't really have much of a taste, but they have some conviction intellectually. That's like the basis of their Krishna consciousness. Then as soon as Srimad Bhagavatam class starts, they're asleep. As soon as they pick up a book to read, they're asleep. Not quite that bad, but something like that, though. The tendency is there, actually. It's a fact. When they come to the level of Nishta, then Srimad Bhagavatam class starts, and even if they're feeling sleepy, but they'll become absorbed in hearing, and their sleep will go because they're fixed like that. On the level of Ruchi, it's said that even if they are asleep, but some chanting, some hearing and chanting begins, then they'll wake up and become absorbed. They won't be able to sleep. Good example is Maharaj Parikshit. 7 days and seven nights he didn't sleep. He just sat. And he was telling the devotees, or Shukadeva particularly, just go on chanting, just go on. I don't care about the snake bird which is coming. But you just go on chanting about the Lord. So he had such a taste for it that he couldn't sleep for 7 days, seven nights. And he lost any concern, even actually for his own death. He didn't care. He said, just let the snake bird come and bite me, I don't care. But you just go on chanting, so I can hear. So this is what it means, that one's attachment for Krishna supersedes all other attachments. So all the other attachments, they just go out the window, gone. And one is absorbed in Krishna consciousness. So it's very, very nice. Unlike in the previous stages, at the stage of Ruchi, constant performance of devotional activities like hearing and chanting does not result in even the least fatigue. Some of you may have had the experience of trying to stay awake on Pandava near Jala Ekadasi? By the time it gets to 2 o'clock, even when you're standing up, you're asleep. Just looking at your watch every 2 minutes. When will Mangalati come and then I can take rest afterwards? But Ruchi means that there's not even the slightest trace of fatigue as long as one is engaged in devotional service. Then turning over to page 20, Ruchi quickly produces an intense addiction to the activities of bhakti. The devotee, because of this taste, very powerful taste of nectar from all devotional activities, the devotee cannot do without it. The devotee must hear and chant about Krishna and be engaged in devotional service. There's no question of spacing out or just, drifting off here and there. No question of it at all. Very advanced. So then in the next paragraph, he gives a very nice example, very practical example. Actually, the same example is given by Rupa Goswami in Nectar of Instruction. The example of a person with jaundice, that we are, from the spiritual point of view, in a jaundiced condition. And part of that condition is that you taste things which are sweet to be bitter. So he's expressing our condition in those terms. But the cure for jaundice is to take sugar, that thing which tastes bitter. That will cure the jaundice, the condition which is producing this bitter experience. So we are told to chant 16 rounds and be engaged in devotional service. But we are not so keen. It's not like we must do it. We have to do it. We may agree to do it, all right, I'll do it. All right, I'll chant 16 rounds. We may agree to do it. But that attraction and taste we don't have. But if one keeps on hearing and chanting and practicing devotional service, then this will cure the very diseased condition which is producing the resistance to engaging in devotional activities. And then gradually one will experience them to be nectar. So then he goes on to explain there are two types of ruchi, two levels of ruchi, actually. One is a level of ruchi where you get great taste. When there's a kirtan, you're so attracted, it's so wonderful, you must be there. And you become absorbed in it, as long as the kirtan leader really knows how to sing. And as long as there's nice madanga playing and cowtels and maybe harmonium and things like that, then oh, it's just nectar. It's just wonderful. And you just become so absorbed, you don't want to be anywhere else. You just forget about anything else. And that's like your world, the kirtan. Or the prasad. If the prasad is just expertly cooked and very nicely done, then again you just become absorbed. This is so ecstatic, so wonderful. Or, of course, that's an easier one, would appear. But it's not so easy. Anyway, we'll talk about that when we talk about the second level of ruchi. Or, he mentions, if someone is talking about Krishna, like here we're talking about Krishna. So now if I was talking about Krishna in a very poetic way, with all sorts of embellishments and, you know, just in a very sophisticated and wonderful way, then such a person would be thinking, wow, this is just ecstatic. And he'd just become absorbed completely. So, but I'm not. I'm just sort of struggling through here. So such a devotee would think, well, if I have to, then I'll stay here, but like that. So the devotee is experiencing ruchi, experiencing that all-absorbing taste, which just captivates the mind, and through which everything else disappears, that is dependent, to some extent, on the excellence of the devotional activities which he is becoming involved in. Then the second level, higher level of ruchi, in other words, progressing towards the next stage, which is asakti, actually. So, it doesn't matter. Even if you are sitting here now, listening to me, sort of mumbling on, he would just be thinking, wow, this is amazing. This is tremendous. And just be totally absorbed. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he would have often, he would have the maha plate brought to him. And he would put his hand in it. And he would just mix everything up. Everything. The sabjis, the dal, the rice, the sweets, the drink, the everything. The chutneys, and just everything. Just mix it till you get this, like, this mess, basically. Which, at least materially, if everything is indistinguishable from everything else, then he'd say, all right, now you go distribute it. And other times, when he didn't do that, he would tell the devotee. There was one devotee whose duty it was to distribute the maha, and he was actually a sannyasi. So, it's an important service. So, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta would ask him, that you note who asks for what, and you tell me. Who asks for the sweet? Who asks for the sabji? And you tell me. So, this higher level then of ruchi means that the devotee is tasting the bhakti. Taste We're talking about taste. So the devotee is tasting the bhakti and the external trappings, which may be material, because if you're an expert musician, or even an expert speaker, very clever in speaking, or an expert cook, or whatever it may be, this is not necessarily spiritual. You just may have that aptitude due to your conditioning. You may be that sort of person. So, when the person is experiencing taste, but they're tasting to some extent the material trappings, then this is a sign of contamination. And Vishnu Chakravarti makes that point. He calls it dosha vas. One should understand this as a taint of impurity in the heart. But where the devotee is simply tasting the bhakti, then this means that it's like a pure spiritual taste and the devotee is quite advanced. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta again, he would often ask one devotee to sing who couldn't sing. We have some devotees like that, sometimes they sing. And it's sort of up and down or flat, it's all on one level. Everyone's wondering, why doesn't he stop singing? I mean, generally they won't leave Ketan, but sometimes you hear them joining in. And it can be a distraction. But he would hear the bhakti. So he would enjoy listening to this devotee sing, even though the devotee couldn't sing. And like this idea of mixing up the prasad. So the devotee's relishing, the prasad would be dependent on the presence of bhakti there. And they would be relishing the bhakti. Otherwise, how are you going to relish your sabji dal mixed in with your orange juice? That's not possible. So there's these two stages in ruchi. So in the fourth paragraph it says that a person with the second type of ruchi, which is the higher type, will experience great pleasure even from the beginning of any performance of hearing and chanting. But now if there is excellence, it'll just increase ecstasy. So it means he hasn't got the slightest trace of impurity in his heart. This is very high level of pure devotional service. And then the next paragraph is very interesting. He is expressing how such a person thinks, or how such a person may speak. And it's quite interesting. O friend, he's expressing great humility. O friend, abandoning the nectar of Krishna's names, why are you engaged in useless talks of family pursuits, of security and enjoyment? What can I say to you? I myself am so wicked. Though I receive the precious jewel of bhakti by the mercy of the spiritual master, I'm so unfortunate that I kept it tied in the hem of my cloth. I just kept it one side, basically. And then he goes on a few more lines down. Alas, such am I, or such is my sense of taste, that I lick up bitter tasting, deceitful, profane gossip like nectar. But I remain apathetic when it comes to the names, qualities, pastimes of the Lord. How unfortunate am I? When I start to hear about the Lord, I comfortably fall asleep. And at the opportunity for vulgar discussion, I prick up my ears and become wide awake. In this way, I've always contaminated the assembly of the devotees. Anyway, so it goes on like this. In this way, repenting his previous state of consciousness, some day at some place, the devotee becomes like a bee, tasting ruchi, tasting the nectar of the fruit of the Madhurya Kadambini, the cloud bank of nectar. So this is taste. This is taste.
Now, of course, one point. Mm-hmm. I found this thing that repeatedly became like a affection for hearing and chanting. Then simply you put the least or to the host of the...
That's all of them. But hearing and chanting are the first two. Yeah. And if you don't have an attachment for hearing and chanting, you can't... There's a hierarchy. You can't really get an attachment for the others. therefore he's referring to hearing and chanting so much.
Yeah.
They're like the foundation activities, hearing and chanting. Harinam, 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 Harinam. It's the only way, really. Everything else is supported by that.
Sometimes you find in the kirtan, and David Swami took up this issue also when he was here, that he wrote a report to the GBC about you being too loud and noisy. So could you comment on that in the light of just taste?
See, it's not exactly related in the sense that he's concerned about health. It's a genuine health matter, apparently. I don't know much about it, but according to what he has researched, if we have our kirtan, but if it's too loud, then it may cause permanent physical damage. And in the future, that may affect our ability to hear and chant about Krishna. Yeah. So, it's not that he's lacking taste, therefore he's objecting. No, actually he likes it. But he doesn't want the danger of this. In fact, I know one devotee, not actually through kirtan, but previously he was involved with guns as a hobby or sport like that, shooting. So, he damaged his eardrums. Now, if you played cartels like we were, just one set of cartels, and it's not terribly strong sound, but it's totally intolerable for him. So he wears these earmuffs, like what people who shoot wear. I don't know if you know what I mean. Yeah, it's like headphones, sort of, but they're not headphones. It's just to insulate his ears from sound, because it causes intense pain to his ears if you just play cartels just one time. It's apparently so. This is the concern of Jayadwaita Swami. But I don't think that he is lacking in taste.
It sounded like he insinuated that was what I didn't. I was just trying to clarify where we were standing. We also had
an objection
like that to a loud kid.
Yeah, well, see, we are on the level of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, and we're meant to be Madhyamadhikaris, or trying to be or become. So that means we have to use our discrimination about what is helpful and what isn't helpful in devotional service. So like that type of thinking, it's a matter of using the discrimination to see what is really helpful in the longer run. Because to have a big, loud kirtan, according to Jayadwaita Maharaj, I mean, some devotees disagree. But according to his understanding, a big, loud kirtan with wampas and crashing cartels and everything means that in the future you won't be able to have nice kirtans. You won't be able to do it. So in the longer term, he sees it as being something which is not conducive to hearing and chanting about Krishna, actually. Even though at this point it may appear to be conducive, that we're getting fired up and, you know, all that stomping around. Right. Yes. We are sometimes a little short on etiquette, though. A little more on the side of enthusiasm. A little shorter on the side of, you know, sophistication, taste, maturity, things like that. So let us go on. How are we doing? Oh, we're doing extremely well. My God. We're going to finish early.
Does this quality of laya, does it progress as one advances in Krishna consciousness? Like
they become less.
They become less.
Yes.
And become more apparent.
Yes, we'll see. As a person is approaching nishta, then these other things will be mainly non-existent. So the main obstacles that he'll be... He practically won't be facing obstacles, because he's coming to the level of nishta. But the only obstacles which will really be there will be these. Now, of course, earlier on, back around here, or particularly back there, it's not that the devotee will not be falling asleep at the wrong time. The devotee will be doing it a lot more. So actually these things will have been reducing. They will have been existing, but reducing. But by the time the person is approaching Nishta, they'll be just about the only problems that the devotee has. What are the others? The others, like, say, just being a... Anyway, the others basically will be more or less non-existent. The tendency to become offensive. One won't have that tendency. It'll be basically gone. Yeah. So that's the idea. So let's go on now to asakti. Asakti is the level that immediately...